This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's episode 29 of Feast Your Ears, and the first episode in season 3. They say third time's a charm, so hopefully this season will be better than the last two. I'm really enjoying doing this show. I hope that those of you out there that are listening are enjoying listening to it. I'd be happy to hear from you if you have any questions about the show or any ideas for guests. You can reach me at harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and I really am trying. I would love to interview an astronaut on my show, so I figured I would reach out to anyone who's listening. If anybody knows an astronaut, please put them in touch with me. I'd love to interview an astronaut about what it's like to eat and cook in space. Joining me today in the studio is Daley Crafton. Daley is a friend of mine, a fellow parent at PS 132 here in Williamsburg, an avid homebrewer, fermenter, yeast whisperer, design guru, and the only person that I know who doesn't have a cell phone at the moment.
I have it, but it's not connected to any sort of network. Right. It's a glorified iPod right now.
So if you want to reach Daley, you pretty much have to go knock on his door or send him an email.
You can call the landline. Yeah. If I'm home.
Right. So thanks for joining me today, Daley.
My pleasure to be here, for sure.
When you meet somebody and they inevitably ask you what it is that you do, because that's the question that we ask here, right?
In this time,
in this place, what do you say?
What I do, like what I do for work?
Well, what do you do? Let's say that, you know, someone comes by your beer box open house and they say, oh, what do you do?
I would say I'm a graphic designer and I run Lockstep Studio, which is a branding and identity studio focusing on craft breweries and local community businesses. That's what I do. To get money, right. You know, for pleasure, it's the fermentation stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. The other things you do, you mentioned before we started the show that you had just had your hands in some compost.
Yeah. So, I mean, this afternoon, right, like just before Harry came to pick me up, I took the compost out because it was very full and very, very fermented, I guess, very decomposed. Put it in there and it just splashed up on my hands and it smelled bad. I guess the conversation was about, like, you know, be careful about comparing that to, like, people's mouths or just places where microbes are. Sorry, you know, it's going to get like this on this show. Sorry.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot of, we'll talk quite a bit about microbes. So in your work with Lockstep Studio, how did you become a graphic designer?
That's actually a pretty good story. So, I mean, you know, I had an artistic knack in elementary, junior high, and high school and all that, drawing and painting, et cetera, all the normal, like, school art type things that you would do, printmaking, so on and so forth, and even, like, to the extent of, like, designing soccer uniforms in my notebook. It's just, like, the stripes went or whatever. They were pretty terrible, I'm sure. But then I actually sang a lot. I'm a trained opera singer, believe it or not. Huh. And when I first went to school, my declared major was voice performance, and I was a voice performance major for one day, and that evening, I just had a realization that I was like, I will never make any money
right.
being an opera singer. Probably not. Some people are very famous opera singers. Sure. But there's like 10 of them,
yep.
And I was probably not going to be one. So I changed my major to graphic design because it was artistic, but also in a way that people would pay you to do it. Like over right. and over and over and over again.
Right. You weren't sitting in a studio making a bunch of stuff and hoping that people were going to wander in or you're going to become famous in the art world or your stuff was going to go to auctions, right?
Right. I wouldn't consider myself that good of an artist anyways, but I think I'm good at design and brands and making sure like that look is tight for your business and
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, we've talked about, Daly and I also are two of the founders of a company called Beerbox, which is a beer-making kit delivery company. If you go to beerbox.co, you can see Daly's design work.
Spelled the German way, yes. B-I-E-R.
B-I-E-R-B-O-X.co. And the idea behind the company is to provide a platform for really excellent homebrew recipes to be delivered to people once a quarter, or more often, but the ideal is once a quarter, who, you know, might be homebrewers who are lapsed or have a bunch of equipment or don't know what they're going to brew next.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty perfect if you feel like you really do want to homebrew, but you're pressed for time.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it.
So in a meeting recently, we were talking about branding, and Daly's done all the branding for Beerbox, and he brought up something, and I think you wrote an article, right, that appeared online about breweries specifically, mm-hmm. all these craft breweries that are blowing up, whose branding is a little bit all over the place.
Yeah, it's a little bit, I think the best word for it is piecemeal. So this occurred to us. We had done some work for a particular brewery, and they were getting their packaging designed by the printer. So they were getting promotional materials designed by the distributor. They were getting their tap handles designed by the tap handle manufacturer, and, you know, their web design by some other person. So you have at least four designers. I mean, which is like, you know, on a large brand, you might have four designers, but like four different companies
right.
designing it. Not like, you know, not like one creative director with like four designers that he's like making yeah. sure it's consistent. Like, it was just like doing it in a vacuum. And so their brand was looking piecemeal.
And I think this is something that comes up not just in breweries.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
It comes up in food brands. I mean, you know, being in this industry, I'm sure that it comes up in other branding as well.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the piece I wrote is basically just, you know, and for obvious reasons, we're a design studio. We want that business, but but it is true that if you hire a branding agency to control that from top to bottom, and the branding agency designs everything, and then they coordinate with the vendors, the printer, the tap handle producer, the web developer, etc., then your stuff is going to look a lot more tight. You're going to have a lot more cohesive look and feel, and it's going to be less confusing to your consumers and translate into, you know, better brand recognition over the long term, for yeah, sure.
Absolutely. I want to move over into talking about food. Have you done any design for food brands?
Food brands. Beerbox.
Yeah.
Do you count Beerbox as a food brand?
I mean, you know, we were also discussing one of the questions that I ask guests before they come on the show is, if they could only have one food for the rest of their life, what would it be? And mm-hmm. you said beer.
I said beer.
And there was a guy who, there's an article, a guy lived for 40 days
yes.
only on beer.
Yeah, I mean, that was a certain order of monks, I don't remember which one, their fast was to only drink this Doppelbock for 40 days.
For Lent.
For Lent, yeah. Yeah. The thing they gave up for Lent was everything except for beer.
Which is awesome. I mean, that sounds like, you know, I know I don't know lots of people right now that still adhere to Lent, but the most common thing I hear from the people that I do are that they give up alcohol or they give up meat.
Right.
Those are like the two most common, I feel like.
Yeah.
But the idea of giving it all up.
The monks did the reverse.
Yeah.
Actually, we're going to keep the alcohol
yeah,
and everything else up.
Makes sense to me. I mean, I could get way more down with Lent if that was how it was approached.
Always. Oh, okay, God. Yeah.
Fine. I'll just drink for 40 days.
It's yeah, cool. It's perfect. I mean, it's not like, it's a funny question because like almost any one choose-you food, I don't think would be nutritive long-term by itself.
Right. Sure.
So I was like, well, I might as well go for the favorite one then.
Yeah.
So beer it was. That yeah. was what I would eat. All right. That's the food I would have if I couldn't have anything else.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Today, I made myself a bacon, egg, and cheese English muffin. I like to protein load in the morning, and then the rest of the day, I usually eat just some vegetables. So, kind of vegetarian. I think that's a good way to go. I think that's what feels good to me. Is if I eat, you know, and sometimes it'll be yogurt in the morning, which I feel like is a pretty good protein as well. Just again, for the microbes that are in it. I like to eat that.
Yeah.
But I like to get after the bacon and eggs in the morning. And that'll really, if I eat that even at like 7 o'clock, that'll float me till about noon. Whereas if I have a bowl of cereal or toast or whatever, you know, I'm hungry again by 10.
Yeah.
So, and then, yeah, for lunch, I'll eat like a little chickpea salad or some sort of, you know, quinoa, some sort of like hearty vegetable. And then, yeah, a little salad or something for dinner a lot of times. But yeah, I like the protein up in the morning. It feels the best.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, the probiotic nature of having something like yogurt. I mean, I try and yogurt, or we often eat natto. We do rice a lot in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
Egg, rice, natto, some sauerkraut, kimchi.
Nice.
Get sort of all the good stuff in there.
Get the microbiome going.
Yeah, totally. What did you eat when you were growing up? What'd your family cook?
Oh man.
Did you guys do fermenting and stuff? Is that where your love of fermentation came from?
No, that started probably 4 years ago. Growing up, the things I remember specifically, so one of the questions was the first thing you cooked, and the first thing I remember cooking, if I can loosely defining cooking, was nachos. And it's not like nachos like you think. It was like putting tortilla chips on a cookie tray and melting pieces of cheese onto those tortilla chips. This was like a late night snack with me and my dad watching Letterman, basically.
Nice.
I also remember a lot of steak and salad, which is kind of a nice, it's a nice combo. Like, I remember my parents like grilling a lot, like grilling a lot of steaks, and with it as a side, usually some sort of a salad. Corn on the cob,
yep.
Just very nice, fresh vegetables and meat. I mean, rolls and stuff, but like that was like bread and like it was all pretty fresh cooked. You can get really good tomatoes in Memphis. There's a town right outside of Memphis called Ripley, Tennessee, and they have legendary tomatoes. So, you know, if you in Memphis, you want to get a hold of the Ripley tomatoes. They're very awesome, very fresh, nice, and just so much flavor. And then the other thing that I remember my mom cooking a lot, for whatever reason, was salmon patties.
Hmm.
Like shredded salmon, you know, like tuna looks, but then like just pan fried in oil.
Right.
Those were really tasty, but I don't know why that was such a thing.
I mean,
such a thing, but family stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my family definitely had those sort of like key recipes that became part of like the canon, right?
I mean
there are recipes I remember my mom cooking. My mom would make ossobuco when it was somebody's birthday. That was always like a celebration dish.
Yeah.
And then my dad, I didn't think about it at the time, now being in the food business and sort of eating much more seasonally, I realized that this is I mean, my dad was eating very seasonally because there was a period of time in the summer where as soon as corn was available in the Northeast,
mm-hmm.
we would have corn every day.
That's awesome.
As fresh as possible, we would have corn on the cob every day, and then we would have Swiss chard when it was available fresh in the Northeast every day. My father would make it, and to the point that I remember my little brother one day standing up at the table, he must have been like 10 years old, being like, I'm not eating any more Swiss chard. Like, I'm done. That's it.
Swiss chard burnout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We, when I was a kid, we also had a thing where my dad became sort of, we would joke that he was Mr. Mom when I was a teenager,
because
we moved cross country and he became Mr. Mom and my mom worked. And he, up to that point, had done most of his like cooking at a firehouse. So he was used to cooking for a bunch of adult men who were really hungry.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there were only four of us. And I remember dinners where we'd sit down and there would be steak and bread and salad and corn and broccoli and Swiss chard. And it just, you know, like on and on and on.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's something I don't know if I struggle with it, but like whenever I'm trying to like make sure the kids eat enough, I'm like, am I like being like too like... I don't want to like force food down their throat. That's such an like American, you like eat past when you're hungry. I definitely don't want to like instill that into them. So, you know, I try to start them actually with like a little less than I think they're going to eat.
Sure.
And then if they're hungry, you get seconds.
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit on something. I think about that a lot too. I mean, you have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I have a 6-year-old and almost 3-year-old, and you know, I find them to be very fickle. Some days, some mornings, you know, Moxie will eat, you know, she'll want 3 servings at breakfast.
Yeah.
And some mornings she won't eat any.
Yeah.
And it's just like this up and down. And, you know, you kind of, you know, especially for me, especially in the mornings, like she needs some kind of protein in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, because she's getting up, she's having breakfast at 7 o'clock and, you know, she's a growing kid. And I know that her attitude is so different if she doesn't eat. And it causes her to have problems with kids in school.
Hangry.
Yeah, she totally gets hangry.
It's real.
It is 100% real. As adults, I think it's real, too. I mean, it's real for us, but we deal with it in different ways. Mm-hmm. We recognize it and are able to kind of, like, hold it back a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of go in a lockdown mode. I know anything that comes in my mouth is going to be rude and unkind. Yeah. So if I'm hangry, I just don't say anything until I've had something to eat.
Yeah, but that takes a huge amount of self-awareness, right? And so, yeah, I mean, the kids, I mean, I, you know, I feel like it's a huge fight. And one of the things that I don't want to do is and I grew up this way. Whatever was being served for dinner is what was for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point when I was old enough, I remember, you know, the answer was, if you don't like it, go make something yourself. But mm-hmm. I'm not going to make you more food.
Right.
Because you decided you didn't like it. And right now I can't quite yet do that. I can't tell my 6-year-old, well, if you don't like it, go make your own dinner.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do that with Chloe now. Chloe's 9. I'll make something. Yeah, for example, like this tahini chickpea salad I made last night. I had leftovers of that today, and I ate that. And I said, "You can have this. If you don't want it, you can make whatever you would like." And she wanted a tuna fish sandwich, and I was like, "Go ahead and make it." But she knows how.
Sure.
So
I think that makes sense. I was talking with another parent recently about the same issue, and what they said basically is that in their house the rule is that if you leave the table, you can't come back.
Oh.
So, you know, if you're sitting at dinner and you decide you're done, because this is something that sometimes Frank will do, but I think it's more a ploy not to go to sleep than because he's really hungry.
Yeah.
He'll be like, but I want to eat more.
Yeah.
After bath, and we're like, you know, reading a bedtime story. He's like, I'm hungry. And, you know, my friend said that the way that his family deals with it is that when you leave the table, that's it. So you better eat what you're going to eat. And, you know, I think that what has then happened is that I'm sure his children have gone to bed a little hungry a couple mm-hmm. times, and then they probably don't go to bed hungry anymore.
Eat a good breakfast the next day.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Not going to starve to death overnight.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, we'll keep talking kids and food and brewing.
Awesome.
Just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
The one and only Dave Arnold brings the noise to Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday on Cooking Issues.
Coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn!
If the bomb was going to drop, and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes. He would be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
If you believe that it's all about to be over, why eat healthy? Not a freaking Neanderthal. I like a tempered ice cream sandwich. But it's the only way to get around it if you're a party master, because you're going to wind up, like, your kitchen's going to fill with dishes. And
some people have commercial dishwashers in their house.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
Really rich people.
For more mile-a-minute knowledge from Dave and the crew, listen to Cooking Issues, available on Heritage Radio Network, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. Today I've been talking with Daley Crafton about our kids and eating and design. I want to move now into talking about fermentation, something that you and I are both very much invested in, in love with, fascinated by. So tell me about, how did you first get into fermenting stuff?
Started with beer, as I think a lot of people probably do.
It's a good place to start.
Yeah, it started with drinking a lot of beer because it tastes good.
And you can live off it, right?
And you can for at least 40 days, as the monks found out. I'd been drinking a lot of beer and going on and on about, oh yeah, maybe one day I'll make some beer. And a friend, for Christmas or birthday, I don't remember, a gift came from a friend, and it was a kit, you know, to make beer. It was one, it was called Brew in a Barrel, I think. And it was like, it was very kind of homemade looking, which is fine because it got me into it. So it was just the ingredients. So I ended up going out and buying the all the stuff, and I made that, and it turned out pretty good. Sounds like
you had a better experience than I did. The first beer I made was horrible.
Oh, really?
I mean, I drank it all. I was like 19.
Right, because you still get buzzed.
Yeah, I mean, I figured out that I couldn't go to the liquor store and buy beer when I was in college, when I first got into college. But I could go to the homebrew store, which was like right down the street, and I could buy all the stuff to make it. So my friends and I were like, oh, we're just going to make our own. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And we made it. And of course, like, we drank it all like faster than we could make it. But it was not good.
Not good beer.
Oh, it was not good.
Was it like not good?
I learned
macro water beer or just...
I mean, what I learned later is that we were not... It really comes down to temperature. I mean, that was the thing. That beer tasted bad because it fermented way too warm.
I see.
We were making an ale that was fermenting, you know, basically in our college dorm kitchen, where the average temperature was, we were on the top floor of the building. I mean, it was probably in the 70s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were just fermenting it way too warm, and I didn't, you know, at the time, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know, well, if the place is that warm, I should use a Saison yeast. And
correct.
You know, I mean, you know, there are ways to, around that. We were making, like, brown ale.
Right.
And it just tastes terrible.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's what was lucky. My first kit that was given to me was a farmhouse ale. And, you know, you can ferment that all the way up to, like, 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And that's appropriate for, like, farmhouse saison. So I just got lucky, I guess.
Yeah.
I loved it. And the thing that has stuck with me from beer brewing is just the microbial aspect of it. Really, really, really love the yeast part. So much so that that's kind of where my beer path has taken me, is down this wild yeast.
Yeah, I mean, you've harvested a bunch of yeast from your own backyard in Williamsburg, right?
Yeah. They have, like, nuanced characteristics. They're definitely similar to each other. They're more similar to each other than they are to any commercial yeast I've ever used.
Right.
It's definitely, I've not gotten any sort of sour anything yet. I think just because the way I'm doing it tends to probably select for Saccharomyces.
Mm.
So everything I've gotten so far has been pretty Saccharomyces-ish. Saccharomyces is like the standard yeast for making beer,
which is cool, because I mean, what a lot of people talk about when they sometimes get, you know, they say their beer got infected with a wild yeast, really they're talking about Brettanomyces more often, right? They're talking about it going super, super dry and getting a little bit funky and not necessarily being in line with what we consider to be the standard beer yeasts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, but like the thing, like, that's the thing too, though, is I'm not so into like this nitty gritty part of brewing, which like makes collecting and using wild yeast be like, well, it's wild yeast. What do you expect? So like that kind of, like, especially for people that are super persnickety about style, like that kind of absolves me of having to be terribly.
Well, I mean, you bring up a really good point. I mean, I've always went on to brew. I mean, I didn't stop brewing after the beer sucked. I, you know, went on and like have made what I consider to be some really great beers, but I was never beholden to this thing that I think happens in the brewing community where people, you know, there's all of these incredibly well-defined styles and they'll have very specific guidelines and people want to get their beer judged to see how well it does against those guidelines. And for me, that part was never interesting. The part that was interesting and awesome is that I could make something really delicious at home with the help of these incredible microbes that you can't even see, really.
Yeah.
And that they're doing all the work. And if you give them the right environment to, like, flourish,
yeah,
produce a really awesome product that you
they're
can drink.
Do it. Yeah, it's true.
And that the flavor profiles are incredible. I mean, the other thing that I always loved about homebrewing, people have asked me over the years, like, wow, why didn't you make wine? Because honestly, and I know, you know, I'm not trying to like downplay the winemaking, but at home, winemaking is not as nuanced as beer making. You can go to a homebrew supply shop, like you can come to the Brooklyn Kitchen, and mm-hmm. with the ingredients there, there is an almost infinite number of different beers you could make.
Yeah.
And to me, that was always super fascinating, that every single one, you could just have some tiny variable and they're different. And that's, you know, we're at a time and a place where we talk about tasting things, whether it's cheese or bread or beer or kombucha or yogurt or meat, and you know, our the human tongue can you know describe and understand all these nuances, and you can make that at home.
Yeah, I think that is the thing I do respect about people that are persnickety about style. You know, Charlie Papazian's of the world, like he's just got an incredible palate, yeah, you know, and can detect it. And I think it's important to the movement, I guess, right, to be able to define and if it's something that needs to be corrected, to know how to do it, or like at least to have an expert to tell you,
yeah,
how you can correct this. So it's not for me. That's not my particular. That's not the angle I'm coming from,
sure,
on it. But I understand and respect that angle. I think it's important. I think that, you know, I think that respect is probably a very important value in that world. I think that sometimes the people that are doing it a little differently, that camp doesn't respect this camp or whatever. Right. But I think as long as you're like really passionate and trying to make something really quality, whether you're like trying to like adhere to a style or just like get your mind around wild yeast, both of those elements are important. I've gotten good at brewing, yeah, like either culturing wild yeast.
I can corroborate that, yeah, statement.
It's never going to be a pilsner, quote unquote, or like a true lager or whatever.
Right.
But it is good beer.
How many different yeasts have you sort of identified and captured in your own backyard?
So, I personally have 3 blends that I've captured. One blend is from, and a blend is 2 or more yeasts. One is from my strawberries. I guess to set it up, like it's not going to taste anything like strawberries. Yeast, right, eats sugar. Saccharomyces eats sugar. So it can be found in abundance on fruiting plants. So I got one off strawberries. I got one off of a blackberry in my backyard, and I got one off of a log. So I have these 3 blends that I've captured. The strawberry one I sent into Jeff Mello at Bootleg Biology, and it had 2 Saccharomyces in it.
Oh, he did the work of actually.
He did. He isolated, yeah, and cataloged them, and he's banked them. He's got a big bank, and so
it's amazing. And that's bootlegbiology.com. Is that where people
that
can
is correct?
Find that?
Yeah. And Jeff is awesome, and I'm looking forward to seeing his talk at American Homebrewers Association. My favorite one though is the log.
The log is a really cool story. Can you tell? I mean, I know it already.
Yes,
but you tell the log story.
I will tell the story. So I like to burn wood in my fire pit, and I go to the park sometimes just to forage for fallen branches and things, and probably not supposed to do that, but it's dead wood, should be fine. So I go and get it and take it home and burn it, and then I found this one log that was really beautiful, and I picked it up and I took it home intending to burn it, but then as I looked at it, I was like, wow, this is a beautiful piece of wood. It was like weathered, it looked like driftwood, been sitting there for years, clearly. I got it like so I jumped over one of the fences into the beds at the park to get it, which, again, you're not supposed to do that, but whatever. It's fine. I got the wood, didn't I? So I had this piece of
and
wood.
And you made the beer.
Yeah, and I made the beer. And we wouldn't have, and so, yeah, I got this wood. It was beautiful. So I decided not to burn it. I was like, maybe I'll lacquer it and make a little piece out of it. But then as I got more and more into wild yeast and wild fermentation, I was reading about how like barrel aged beers are like got all this microbes living in the wood barrel, and they come out and ferment the beer. And then, you know, in olden times, apparently there was like the family paddle or whatever that you, right, would stir the beer with, and they thought it was magic.
But the, it was just the yeast.
He's living
on the wood. Yeah,
munching on the little tiny wood sugars, like very slowly over time. I mean, that's essentially what decay is.
Yeah,
is little microbes just eating away at that thing, you know, in the elements as well. But so I was like, I bet you there is a super colony of yeast in this log. So I brewed up a 5-gallon batch and put the log down in it and put a rock on the log to weight it down. And sure enough, just like the next day, whoa, mad Krausen. Krausen is like the layer of yeast on top, just bubbling up. It was awesome. Problem was, the rock that I used leached a bunch of mineral flavors into the beer, so that batch was terrible. But then I made a second batch with it, and it without the rock, and it was awesome.
So I think the lesson here is that everybody should be making log beer.
Right.
I mean, I sort of, you know, to play this out into the future, I think it'd be fascinating if, you know, you have craft breweries all over the place. You have people talking about sourdough and you can capture mm-hmm. sort of local yeast microbes anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really amazing if you got to a point where breweries were making.
They're starting
and capturing
to.
Their yeast. I mean, they are starting to, right? I mean, it's a really, to me, that's a fascinating, amazing, we're in an amazing time because that's how everybody did it in the past, but they didn't know that's how they were doing it.
Right.
Then we got to the point of having it be completely commercialized right. and everybody wanted things to be sterile and you kill all the old bacteria and you put in the yeast you want. And now sort of returning back to this yeast of place, I think is really cool.
Yeah. There's a guy named Christopher from NYU. He discovered, I can't remember how, but he's a journalism student. And he's writing about terroir in New York City. Terroir. I can't say that word. But he interviewed me about the hyperlocal yeast that I'm capturing. Catskill Brewery has a wild ale out right now. It is the cloudiest, turbid beer I have ever seen. Like, it's like you think your homebrew is cloudy. This beer is like drinking. It's like milk beer almost. But it was really good, and it actually reminded me a lot, like flavor profile wise, of like the stuff that I'm making with these strains yeah. that I captured. It had that like, just like that back end bite.
Well, I mean, you know, it's when I was in Japan recently, and actually at the next Sumo Stew event that I'll be hosting with Michael Harlan Turkel, who's also a host here on Heritage Radio. His show is called The Food Scene. Mm-hmm. We host a party every other month to watch sumo from Japan at the Brooklyn Brewery. The next one is coming up on the 17th of May, sumostew.com, but we're actually going to be pouring a couple of sakes there that are made from wild captured yeast.
Awesome.
There's a sake brewery called Amabuki, and they do one with a strawberry yeast
uh-huh.
and one with a sunflower yeast. And when our friend Chizu originally got in touch with us, and you know, she's a brand rep for a bunch of different sake companies, and we said, oh, do you want to be a part of this? She said, oh yeah, I'm going to bring this strawberry sake. And of course, the place my brain went was that it was going to be some pink beverage
strawberry
sake mixed with strawberry extract, and I was like, okay, I mean, it's free, but do we really yeah. want that? And then she brought it and opened it up, and I tasted it. I was like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, it's made from strawberry yeast. And I said, oh, you didn't say
it's
that
different.
You called
it's
it strawberry
different.
Sake. You need to this. I was like, you really should change the whole marketing of this. Like, you need to market it as strawberry yeast.
That's one of the things that I've like find I guess difficulty is like describing the yeast,
because right.
I know as soon as I like, the only way I can describe it is where I caught it from,
right, the origin,
because I don't it's not any sort of market. I don't know what it's going to be like until I brew with it.
Sure.
But
it also is not necessarily native to strawberries.
No.
You just happen to capture
yeah,
it off a strawberry
exactly.
where it
so
was living.
The description of any yeast that I capture ends up being very wordy.
Yeah.
This is a yeast I captured off a strawberry, but you should not expect it to taste anything like strawberries. That's like the whole description.
Well, we've reached the end of our time here together on the radio, but I wanted to give you an opportunity if you have any events coming up at Lockstep, or you know, if you want to talk for a minute about the poster shop you guys run out of there, to tell people about how they can find you.
Yeah, we're Lockstep Studio, branding and identity studio, but we are focused on craft breweries for the design work we do and local community businesses, because we love our neighborhood and we want to see it thrive, and so we're hoping to partner with local companies to do their design work. We have a poster shop ourselves, so we are a local business. It's just design posters that we've made that we think are nice, and it's 311 Graham Avenue, 11211. just go to lockstepstudio.com and shoot us an email, because right now it's open sporadically, basically as like as we feel like it.
Right.
yeah, and I'll be at the Craft Brewers Conference in Philadelphia and the Homebrewers Conference in Baltimore. If anybody listening is going to either one of those, hit me up. We can chit-chat about whatever.
Cool. Well, thanks, Daly, for coming on the show today. Really,
thank you,
really
Harry.
Appreciate
it's awesome.
It. Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to Kristen Baylor, who's my producer, and David Tatasciore for engineering. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. And follow me on Instagram and Twitter at TheFoodBaller. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.